to Home Lab Highlights, the show that surfaces practical home lab wins and useful self-hosted tools. Welcome to the News Roundup. I'm host A.
And I'm host B. Let's start with a story that's hitting close to home for anyone who builds containers. Following the TanStack compromise, a discussion on YouTube asks what Dockerfile practices are mandatory today that you wouldn't have cared about 3 to 5 years ago. The conversation, summarized by a user named FlossPatrol76, argues that the Dockerfile itself isn't the primary weak spot in supply chain attacks. The key advice is to pin base images by their SHA-256 digest, not by tags, and to have CI verify a lock file instead of trusting whatever the registry hands you at build time. Practices like running as non-root, using multi-stage builds, and dropping build tools from the final image are framed as ways to shrink the blast radius after something slips in. Important, but second order.
That's a grounded, specific take on hardening our build pipelines. It's a significant shift in mindset from just a few years back, where latest tags were common and the registry was implicitly trusted. The discussion points out that a compromised base image, even one you've used for months, can bypass most runtime security measures if it's pulled fresh every build. This makes the move to verified, immutable digests and lock files feel less like a best practice and more like a fundamental requirement for any production-facing container workflow now. The user specifically notes that a lock file, which records the exact digests of all layers at build time, creates a reproducible artifact that CI can validate against future builds, catching any unexpected changes before they're deployed. It's a concrete step that moves security left in the pipeline, from runtime detection to build time verification.
Exactly. And this isn't just theoretical. The TanStack incident, where a malicious package was distributed via a compromised NPM account, showed how quickly a trusted dependency can turn into a vector. For container builds, the base image is that foundational dependency. Relying on a mutable tag like Ubuntu:22.04 means you're implicitly trusting the registry maintainers and their signing keys every single day. Pinning to a digest like #256ABC123 decouples that trust, making your build deterministic. It's a small change in the Dockerfile that carries a huge weight for integrity. The community discussion emphasizes that this practice, combined with a software bill of materials or SBOM generation, should now be the baseline for any serious home lab service that faces the internet or handles sensitive data.
Shifting to software licensing, Ars Technica reports that Jam Software, the company behind the disk space analyzer TreeSize, is no longer offering support or updates for perpetual licenses beyond their maintenance period unless customers subscribe. Product manager Hendrik Christ cited current economic conditions as making the change necessary for long-term development. The company also has a long-standing policy of not providing license keys or installers to customers after their support period ends, urging them to make their own backups. This has frustrated users who feel stripped of the ability to download software they already paid for.
The frustration seems to center on the distinction between ownership and access. Users who purchased a perpetual license for, say, TreeSize Professional 2024, expected to be able to download and install that specific version indefinitely, even if they wouldn't get new features. Jam Software's policy effectively turns that perpetual license into a time-limited download voucher, unless the user proactively archives everything. It's a stark reminder that in the shift to subscription models, the burden of archival and long-term access often falls entirely on the end user, even for software marketed as a one-time purchase. The Ars article notes that this policy isn't new, but the cessation of updates for non-subscribers has brought it back into sharp focus. One user commented they'd been a customer for over a decade, but now feel the rug has been pulled out, as their archived installer from 2022 can't be reactivated without contacting support, which is now a paid service.
It's a practical lesson in vendor lock-in and asset management. For home labbers who rely on proprietary tools for critical tasks like storage analysis, this underscores the importance of treating software licenses as physical assets. You wouldn't buy a drill and then let the manufacturer take it back after a year. The article suggests that the response from the community has been to double down on documentation and local backups, and for some, to reevaluate open source alternatives like WinDeerStat, WizTree, or even scripting your own analysis with tools like NCDU. While TreeSize offers deep Windows integration and speed, the licensing shift makes its total cost of ownership, including the ongoing labor of maintaining your own archive, much less clear.
And in hardware news, The Verge covers a new minimalist flip phone from Lite, set to ship early next year. The Lite Flip is a $299 device designed as a second phone with a 2.8-inch non-touchscreen, a number pad, and the same Lite OS software as their more expensive Phone 3. Co-founder Kai-Wei Tang says they're responding to users, particularly young ones, who don't want to be seen using a smartphone. Lite recently released an SDK for its app Toolbox, allowing users to write their own software for the device. Tang notes that in his interviews with young people, no one wants an AI button on their phone.
The home lab angle here is intriguing. With an open SDK, this could become a novel, ultra-low-power endpoint for notifications or simple control panels. Imagine a dedicated, pocketable device that just shows your server status or lets you trigger a backup. It's a niche, but it speaks to a growing interest in devices that do less, on purpose, and give the user more direct programming control instead of layering on AI features. At $299, it's not an impulse buy, but for tinkerers looking for a distraction-free hardware platform, it's a curious new option. The SDK, based on their Toolbox app framework, uses a Python-like syntax and can interface with the device's modem, display, and buttons. For a home labber, you could theoretically write a script that pings your home server via SMS or a lightweight API and displays OK or Alert on the screen. It's the antithesis of the all-in-one smartphone, carving out space for single-purpose, user-programmable gadgets in a world of hyper-convergence.
For our tool highlight, we're looking at a project born from frustration with existing remote access tools. HostB, what's the story with US Bridge-Remote?
It's a free, open-source project from a developer who was tired of tools that force mandatory registration, hide features behind subscriptions, and rely on third-party cloud servers. US Bridge Remote combines a software agent with a hardware KVM client. The hybrid approach is the key. You can manage a running OS through the software agent, but if the machine is stuck in the BIOS, fails to boot, or freezes, you can switch to the hardware KVM level using a device called the US Bridge KVM 2.0. This addresses the classic lights-out management problem for systems that don't have expensive IPMI or iDRAC cards, like many consumer-grade boards in a home lab.
That's a clever failover. It turns a common pain point, needing physical access to troubleshoot a failed boot, into something you can handle remotely if you've invested in the specific hardware dongle. What about the tech stack and practical setup?
The developer integrated the Sunshine and Moonlight protocols for streaming, supporting up to 2000 resolution at 240 frames per second, which is overkill for most admin work, but great for latency-sensitive tasks. Tailscale is built directly into the agent for peer-to-peer WireGuard connections, with zero-tier integration in development, so you're not reliant on port forwarding or a central relay server. A big note for Linux users is that native Wayland support works out of the box, which is still a hurdle for many remote desktop solutions. The project is in beta, with builds for Windows, macOS, Linux, and Android, and an iOS client in the App Store. The developer is also finalizing pre-login support for Windows and Linux display managers, which would close the last gap before the hardware KVM is needed.
So the operational detail here is understanding the two-tiered approach. The software agent is your first line of defense for daily remote access, leveraging efficient modern protocols. The US Bridge KVM 2.0 hardware, which you'd need to purchase separately, acts as your emergency fallback for low-level system recovery. It's not a single magic bullet, but a thoughtfully layered system that gives you different tools for different failure modes, all while keeping control and connectivity in your own hands. The hardware dongle connects via USB to the target machine and HDMI for video capture, and it's powered and controlled over the network by the US Bridge Remote software. This means you don't need a separate power outlet or a monitor at the remote site. The dongle sits in line between the server's video output and a dummy HDMI plug or monitor. In a failure scenario, you'd access the dongle's interface through the software to inject keyboard and mouse signals and view the raw video feed, effectively giving you a physical presence. It's a more elegant solution than a full IP KVM switch for a single machine, though it does require the target system's USB to be powered on, which is usually the case even in a failed boot state.
Our community highlight today is less about a specific build and more about a critical conversation. A massive feature in The Verge, supported by the Tarbell Center for AI Journalism, digs into the environmental and societal impact of GPUs, the backbone of the current AI boom. This isn't just about big data centers. It's a lens through which home labbers running local LLMs or inference clusters can consider the broader footprint of their hardware choices.
The scale is staggering. Researcher Xiaolei Ren at UC Riverside estimates the energy needed to train a model like Meta's Llama 3.1 can create as much air pollution as 10,000 round trips by car between Los Angeles and New York City. His work suggests public health costs from AI-related air pollution could reach over $20 billion by 2028. And it's not just carbon. AI is an incredibly thirsty business, with water use for cooling spiking during heat waves, putting sudden stress on local water systems. For instance, a Google data center in the Dalles, Oregon, used over a quarter of the district's total water during a drought, primarily for cooling its AI chips.
The impact extends through the entire life cycle, from mining to disposal. PhD candidate Sophia Falk has studied the material footprint of NVIDIA's A100 GPU, finding it's 90% heavy metals like copper, iron, tin, and nickel. Training a model like GPT-4 could mean extracting and eventually dumping up to 7 tons of toxic elements. Then there's e-waste. Researcher Alex DeVries Gao estimates AI servers could create e-waste comparable to all the e-waste produced by a country like Denmark or Norway each year by 2030. This is accelerated by the rapid hardware churn in AI, where new architectures can make last year's $10,000 card obsolete for cutting-edge work.
The article presents this not as a call to abandon technology, but as a necessary scrutiny, a call for informed consumption. Professor Catherine Flick calls generative AI totally one of those classic solutions looking for a problem. The researchers argue for a sufficiency mindset, asking if a 2% gain in AI model capability is worth doubling its environmental toll, and for more accountability from tech companies in their supply chains and local community impacts. For the home lab community, this translates to questions we can ask ourselves. Do I need to run that model locally 24/7, or can it be scheduled for off-peak hours? Is buying a used enterprise GPU for inference more responsible than chasing the latest consumer card? It's about integrating environmental cost into our technical calculus.
Absolutely. The article, which is based on interviews with over a dozen researchers and reviews of published studies, provides a framework we can use. For example, when considering a new GPU purchase, look beyond flops and VRAM. Consider its expected lifespan in your lab, its power efficiency under your typical loads, and the possibility of buying refurbished. The piece notes that the push for ever larger models creates a Jevons paradox effect, where efficiency gains are consumed by scale, leading to greater total resource use. On a home lab scale, we might ask if a smaller, quantized model running on efficient hardware meets 95% of our need with 10% of the power draw. It's a complex trade-off between capability, curiosity, and conscience, but having this data moves the conversation from vague guilt to informed decision-making.
Here's a quick, practical tip grounded in today's stories. If you use TreeSize or any software with a perpetual license that includes a support period, take a moment today to back up your installer file and license key. As we saw with TreeSize, once that support period ends, you may lose access to downloads from the vendor. Having that local backup ensures you can reinstall the version you paid for on your terms. It's a simple bit of administrative hygiene that protects your investment. Expand this to your entire software toolkit. Create a dedicated, encrypted archive for installers and licenses. For open source tools, consider also archiving the specific version's source code. This practice turns software ownership from a promise into a tangible asset you control.
To build on that, make this backup process part of your procurement routine. The moment you purchase a perpetual license, before you even install the software, download the installer and any license file or activation key. Store them in your archive with a clear file name that includes the version number and purchase date. For extra resilience, consider using a cloud storage sync for the archive, but ensure it's encrypted if it contains license keys. This isn't just about licensing. It's about preserving your ability to rebuild your home lab environment from scratch with the exact software versions you've tested and trust, even if a vendor changes their policy or disappears entirely. It's a small time investment that pays massive dividends in independence and recoverability.
And on that note of taking control, happy hosting. That's HomeLab Highlights for Tuesday. Until next time, happy hosting.